2016, and the time is 9:03 a.m. I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. There is a quorum with 10 members present. Victor Leal has contacted me. Thank you. Now I can drag everybody back into the room.
That's what I was waiting for.
Thank you. Okay, hold on then. In that case. Victor Leal has contacted me and indicated that he would not be able to attend the meeting. And before we talk about handling the absence, I'd like to also make mention that Victor has submitted his resignation from the Finance Commission. It has become difficult for him to honor his work commitments and the commission, and it's made it difficult for him to continue to serve. And in that vein, we'll continue. And so with that, he did request that his absence be excused, but in accordance with the Finance Code 11.103, the commission members will take a vote whether to accept or to deny this request. All in favor of excusing the absence, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and the absence will be excused. I have notified the governor's office. They will be looking for a replacement, and until that person is named, he does continue to serve. But we want to thank Victor very much for his service, and we will look forward to a new member on the commission, which if we have to get another new member on the commission and acclimate somebody else, I guess throw them all in and let's pile it in now while we're working on getting everybody acclimated. Certainly, it will just add another hopefully very competent candidate to the commission.
And that was a public
seat. That was a public seat, yes. Thank you. We'll move into Finance Commission matters. Actually, before we get started, let me make mention of one other thing. This is our inaugural live webcast day. And so for those of you who have nothing better to do and you want to watch the live stream of the Finance Commission because you cannot attend, you are now able to do that as long as you register. But if you are unable to attend, or we feel like just reaching out for those who maybe aren't aware of us or aren't familiar with what we do and the actions that we take, this will be a very good opportunity to get us out and become more well-known. So we are live streaming today. There is a camera in the back of the room. We did just go into the office to take a look at what it looks like, and so please be cognizant, members, that you are in full view today. With that,
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Are we able to tell how many viewers we have at a certain moment in time?
Well, we had 12 people.
Woohoo!
And six of those were DOB people, but, you know.
Like I said, when you have nothing better to do, the Finance Commission, it's sort of like C-SPAN for the Finance Commission.
Well, we can only go up, right?
Yes, we can.
We had the
I'm not sure about that.
We had a consumer group. We had one or two attorneys. So, I mean, I think after this meeting, if it works properly, we can also do a press release, and that will put it out there a little bit more.
Which would be great.
We sort of wanted to make sure that it was going to work.
And if any of you want to see what it looks like on a break or so, you can step into the office right here and you could see what it looks like. Okay, moving on to Finance Commission matters.
Just one other question.
Yes.
I assume that when we take a break, the audio is paused and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, but the picture's still there.
Yes. What I've been told, we'll verify.
We will check that. Any other questions? Okay. Moving on to the consent calendar, minutes in particular, which are found in the Finance Commission section, page 20, item A1. Any changes to the minutes? Okay. General comment, I have not received a card from anybody. Is there nobody is testifying this morning? Okay. So if there is anybody wishing to address the commission during the time of public comment, please fill out a witness form and bring it up to the front. Moving on to the consent agenda, which again is in the Finance Commission section, page 20. Members, before we take up the consent agenda items, A1, B5 through B7, C2 through C4, and D2 through D7 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item can be removed from the consent agenda and placed on the regular agenda so that may be discussed and voted on individually. So, are there any items anybody would like to remove from the consent agenda? Hearing no objections from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt the following consent agenda items without discussion? A1, B5 through B7, C2 through C4, and D2 through D7.
So moved.
Thank
Second.
You. So Jay first, second, Will? Okay. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes. Before we get to Finance Commission operations, let me also point out in your books on page 22 is the upcoming rule schedule for future meetings. And as I mentioned at the last meeting, for the new members' benefit, we will continue throughout the year to do brief summaries in advance of any new rule to help acclimate people, and that will be provided. It will be brief. With respect to the actual rules that are upcoming, which is page 22, we have residential mortgage loan servicers, residential mortgage loan companies, mortgage bankers, and residential mortgage loan originators, credit access businesses, operation of pawn shops, and prepaid funeral contract forms, all in August. So we'll cover a myriad of different entities, so you will get briefings on that before we have to take any action on any rules. One other thing I'd like to mention this morning before Charles talks about Finance Commission operations, I would like to officially congratulate Charles on becoming chairman of CSBS. That is a tremendous accomplishment for him personally, for the agency, for the Finance Commission, and just for Texas, and just in general. It's a wonderful accomplishment. I'd like to read the press release for the record, for those of you who didn't see it. Sorry, Charles. On May 24th, 2016, at CSBS State Federal Supervisory Forum in Denver, Colorado, Banking Commissioner Charles G. Cooper was elected as chairman to the 2016-2017 Conference of State Bank Supervisors Board of Directors. It is comprised of 20 state supervisors, has supervision, control, and direction of the affairs of CSBS, its affiliates, committees, publications, determines its policies, and actively pursues its objectives. He had previously served as vice chair prior to when he was escalated to the position of chairman, and he is an active member of their executive committee, their legislative committee, regulatory, non-depository, emerging payments, and then also member of the community bank steering group. So with that, just want to extend our congratulations and thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Congratulations. And with that, let's move on to the Finance Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. it dawned on me, with the new members, I'd just like to reiterate, I think all of you, you've had your training session, if you will, but I really want to say that for the three commissioners, three agency heads, if you have any questions about anything on the agenda that you would like to talk about or clarify, feel free to call us and let us do that for you. Don't feel uncomfortable in doing that, because if you have a question, I think we would like to give you the information. Would y'all
yes,
agree with
definitely.
That?
Yes, mm-hmm. Definitely.
So for the Finance Commission operations, as y'all know and just heard, we spent a lot of time on the strategic plan. So I'm trying to, it seems like it's been a very busy time since our last meeting. A lot of work on that. Yesterday, before the House Business and Industry Committee, myself and Philip Hinkle, who is our IT Security Examination Director, testified on cybersecurity and gaps in cybersecurity for businesses. And I thought the hearing went well. At least in my opinion, the outcome that came out that there needed to be more information shared to businesses to help them on the cybersecurity issue. And I think there'll be an initiative created to do that. Madam Chair, also, if I could, I'd like to just say something about when I was elected, it was in Denver on the 24th of May. And then I gave my, quote, acceptance speech in 26, which I believe was, you at least got the link to it. One of the things, and I think this is very important, one of the things that I said, and it impacts not just the banking department, but all three agencies, is that in our regulatory situation, we deal with our federal counterparts. And my message was that we had to have more collaboration and cooperation with our federal counterparts. Not only the federal banking agencies, but now the CFPB. And so I made the comment that I probably equally insulted all of them. and basically challenged them to agree. Also said, as an example, 77% of all banks in the country are state chartered. That's a huge number. I mentioned that before. And that means that as a group, we regulate more than any other regulator. So I'm not sure that people are aware of that, but we're going to be talking about that quite often. I have mentioned that to some of our elected officials, that when they talk about bank regulation, they need to have us there to talk about it. So.
And Charles, if I might, just for a moment, the CFPB director, Rich Cordray, was in town. He met with all three agencies, came to Texas, spent a lot of time with our agencies, which just tells you that, you know, they value what's going on in Texas.
So with that, that's all of the general issues that we have.
Okay, thank you. Audit Committee report, Molly.
Okay, thank you. The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner's Fiscal Year 2016 Annual Internal Audit Report as prepared and presented by Garza Gonzalez and Associates.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted.
And then regarding the Department of Banking's internal audit report, I want to make note of one recommendation made by Garza that the Department of Banking disagrees with, and it deals with the testing of the records retention schedule. So as noted in the report, it makes mention that it has been the Department of Banking's practice not to delete existing record series from the RRS to avoid the administrative burden in the event of restatement of these records. I understand that there was discussion that was had with Garza and the Department of Banking, and in the result of that is that the Department of Banking will review the records and consider those that are no longer relevant, but there's an issue that if they remove items that could be legislatively required in the future, it causes a timing issue, it causes some consternation. And so part of their recommendation was accepted, but I don't believe that it is reasonable to have them remove all the records. And I just want to make note with that, I've talked with the Garza partner, and she agreed that they had no issue with the response that was given by management, but I think it's important to note in the minutes that part of their recommendation will be accepted, and another part is going to be, for reasonableness, it's not going to be implemented. So with that, I would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Banking's Fiscal Year 2016 Annual Internal Audit Report as prepared and presented by Garza Gonzalez and Associates.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any further discussion?
Yeah, if we could just maybe talk about the timing of the record retention, just perhaps to, is it all in line with IRS record keeping, or is it beyond that?
Stephanie.
The records retention schedule, there are some things that are mandated by the government code of how long you keep them. But a lot of is left to the discretion of the agency, but it has to be approved within the guidelines of the level of government, or the area, what's the name of the agency?
State Library and Archives.
God, thank you. And so we tell them what we think for each line item. The one in question, or the great example for the one in question, is the legislative appropriation request. That still shows up on our list. And our list is looked at every 5 years. And a legislative appropriation request is what we used to do to get appropriations every 2 years from the legislature for our budget. But because we're SDSI, we no longer have that requirement. And so the Garza recommendation was to take that out. And we disagreed because if the legislature put us back in, then we wouldn't have a retention column for that, and we would have to wait until the five-year review to add it back. And so for us, it just seemed more prudent to leave it in there and not use it. But it's not, I think it's all different than the IRS, like how long you have to keep a tax return. It's totally different than this. And it is extremely detailed. I mean, it's just pages and pages of different kinds of documents. And there's different levels for each one of those documents, or different dates or requirements to keep.
And my understanding is that you will go through and you'll delete the ones that you don't think will have any, will resurface, right?
Yeah, it could be something like where you don't do something any longer, like there's an area of regulation or something that you no longer even do, and so you wouldn't need information related to that any longer. Yes, we would eliminate it, but not the legislative mandated ones.
Stephanie, to what extent are we talking about electronic documents, and we're talking, and to what extent are we talking about paper documents?
Well, we're all electronic now, so for ours, it's everything's electronic, and so we have a schedule that comes out twice a year, and it's gone to, given to each director, and that was one of the things in the audit that's given to each director, and it says, you have all of these documents, and based on the record retention schedule, say it's like after close plus 3 years, the date that document was dated in the imaging system as done, after close plus 3 years, it's now been 3 years, you need to look at that to see if it needs to be deleted. And then if it's not to be deleted, a reason why.
The logic for record retention and destruction policies used to be that you had a voluminous room containing mm-hmm. a lot of paper documents. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you would need to, for purposes of economy, destroy documents that are no longer useful. Now that documents are retained in electronic form, and my sense is the quantum of electronic data isn't significant, what's the rationale for document destruction now?
I think it's because they tell us it is. I really don't know. I totally agree with you. There is some things though, like for open records requests. If you get an open records request and you have documents that are past the retention schedule, say you kept 20 years of extra of documents, you've got to go through that 20 years worth of documents to look to see if there's anything in those that meet that open records request. So I know.
So there's still an efficiency.
Yeah. That's part of it, but in terms of space and storage, because we used to have paper records at the archives, and we had to pay a monthly fee to have them there.
Right.
But now everything's electronic. But other than the open records, I don't really know what the rationale is.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a legal question too, not just open mm-hmm. records. If you're having to respond to discovery
right.
requests and whatever, the more records you have, the more you potentially have to
yeah,
manage.
But that's an efficiency.
Right.
That's an efficiency
right.
standard.
Right. right.
But I think that I know we have discussions when something comes up that's on the schedule, and like Stephanie said, if we disagree, we tell them why. We talk about it quite often because history sometimes is very good on certain issues.
Right.
So.
Right.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Okay. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
Okay. The audit committee would also like to make a motion that the Finance Commission extends the internal auditor contract for Garza, Gonzalez, and Associates for fiscal year 2017.
Coming upon recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted.
And finally, we also had an update regarding the Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund, and this was not an action item at this time.
Okay, thank you. Moving on, the Strategic Planning Committee report. Will?
Before moving in, I would like to, there again, thank everyone for all of their help with the plan, and I do encourage all of the commission members to study these plans. They're very well written and very concise as far as the goals for each commission. The Strategic Planning Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the 2017-2021 strategic plans.
Okay. Coming upon recommendation from the Strategic Planning Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? If I might mention, I'll discuss. So as we talked about at the committee level meeting, we had new instructions in a new format, and it was a significant amount of work from all three agencies, especially as late in the process as we got the instructions. So a great deal of work had been done and then had to be redone to incorporate the instructions received. So in particular, each agency had a point person, and so Department of Banking, that would be Barbara, and with Savings and Mortgage Lending, that would be Stephen, and with OCCC, that would be Juan. But in addition, there are a lot of other people who worked really hard on this that I'd just like to mention for the record. So with respect to Department of Banking, Stephanie and Wendy, also thank you very much for your work, and for Savings and Mortgage Lending, Antonia and Tony, thank you very much also. And then with OCCC, Rudy, Michael, Matt, Moran, Alfredo, and Nancy, thank you. So everybody worked really hard for this final output, and also to the committee, which I greatly appreciate, since this was a new chair and new committee members. And as you can see, we hit the ground running at the Finance Commission. You don't get a lot of time to get caught up. So Will, Philip, and Bob, thank you very much. And with that, any other discussion? Okay. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion's adopted. And did you want to mention the Finance Commission plan?
Next on the agenda, as we discussed earlier, is the Finance Commission's plan. And that we will vote to approve in August, as we've gone over earlier. We had an update regarding the 2017 strategic plan for the Texas Finance Commission. It's not an action item at this time, but just for discussion, I think we've already been over.
Yes, and so in here, page 3, you've got your the instructions. We'll be working on that draft so that we can approve it by August. Thank you. Item 7, discussion of and possible vote to take action on the adoption of the completed rule review of 7 TAC Part 8, Chapter 151, concerning home equity lending procedures, Chapter 152, concerning repair, renovation, and new construction on homestead property, and Chapter 153, concerning home equity lending, and that is found in the Finance Commission section, page 23.
Good morning, members. I'm Matt Nance, Deputy General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. I'll be discussing really two items on the agenda. There's A7, which is an adoption of a rule review for the home equity interpretations, and A8, which is a proposal of amendments based on that review. And all of that is on pages 23 to 40 of the materials. To give some background on what these home equity interpretations are, the Texas Constitution allows lenders to make home equity loans, but it has some fairly detailed requirements on disclosure, fee limitations, a limitation on loan to value, and so forth. The Finance Commission and Credit Union Commission have authority to adopt interpretations of the Constitution's home equity provisions. The commissions originally adopted their interpretations in 2004. The interpretations are drafted and prepared by the Joint Financial Regulatory Agencies, which are, it's a work group of the Texas Department of Banking, Texas Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, the OCCC, and the Texas Credit Union Department. The amendments we have today came out of rule review. The interpretations are subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, which requires review of rules every 4 years to make sure they should still exist and to update them if necessary. So that was the impetus for the proposed amendments. The amendments we've got are fairly technical, but I wanted to point out two changes in particular. One has to do with pre-closing disclosures. The Constitution requires lenders to provide a pre-closing disclosure of fees and costs. The current interpretation says lenders can provide the HUD-1 form, but recently the CFPB adopted a rule with TILA-RESPA integrated disclosures that replace the HUD-1 form. So one of the amendments replaces language to refer to the currently required federal disclosures. Some other amendments relate to who is authorized to make a home equity loan. The Constitution has a list of types of lenders authorized to make home equity loans. Since the interpretations were originally adopted, there have been some changes to the licensing provisions of the Finance Code. In particular, there were amendments to Chapter 156, which SML regulates, that replaced the term mortgage broker with residential mortgage loan company or residential mortgage loan originator. So the proposal includes some amendments explaining that issue, including that Chapter 156 licensees are mortgage brokers for purposes of the Constitution. As far as kind of the process we went through, we had a couple work group meetings among the agencies to discuss the rule review. We published a notice of intent to review the rules, and we got an official comment on that, which is printed in the meeting materials. We incorporated some of the commenters' recommendations into our proposal, although there were also some that we disagreed with for reasons discussed in the preamble to the rule review adoption. Then we prepared a draft of the amendments. We sent out a pre-comment draft to stakeholders. We got some informal pre-comments that have helped us prepare the proposal. And currently we have the proposal today. So that's been the process so far. And I also wanted to briefly outline the process going forward, because since it involves the Finance Commission as well as the Credit Union Commission, and the Credit Union Commission has kind of staggered meetings, I wanted to just go through the timeline of what we currently anticipate would happen. So here's how we've initially thought the rule actions would be scheduled. So today, the Finance Commission would vote on whether to publish the amendments for comment. The Credit Union Commission has a July 10th meeting where they would vote on whether to publish the amendments for comment. Stakeholders would have 30 days to file official comments. The amendments would get published in the Texas Register probably late July. Stakeholders would have 30 days to comment, late July, first part of August. The agencies would review the official comments, and then we'd present amendments for adoption at the Finance Commission's October 21st meeting and the Credit Union Commission's November 4th meeting, and then the amendments would go into effect in late November. So that's the current timeline we've got. So that's kind of what the proposed amendments are and what the rule review process has been. I'm happy to answer any questions, if there are any.
Well, we discussed the Supreme Court's, the Texas Supreme Court decision today. Does it affect what you're doing now?
No, the subject matter of these amendments doesn't really have to do with the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Finance Commission versus Norwood. We are amending one of the rules that was part of that case, but our amendments are just to add the word equity before loan to ensure consistent terminology, and don't really have to do with the holding of that case.
Did that case challenge the commission's interpretations back in 2004?
Yeah, it did. And the court upheld some of our interpretations and struck down some other ones. And we had, I guess it was in 2014 and 2015, we had some rulemaking actions that implemented that decision and struck the language that the court has struck down. So those amendments happened in 2014. And these amendments we've got today don't so much relate to the subject of that case.
So Matt, just to be clear, is the Norwood case what I call the Acorn case? Is that the same case?
Yeah.
Okay. And we're probably too early in the process now to really know whether our final efforts in this coming interpretation are sufficiently disagreeable that there might be some others who would engage in that activity again. Is that fair to say?
Oh, you mean litigate against us?
Yeah. I mean, we won't know that until we actually do the final interpretation.
That's right. I actually got an email from one of the attorneys who represented the plaintiffs in the Norwood case saying that he didn't really see anything that grabbed him in the interpretations. But it's correct, we won't know for sure. But in my view, these are pretty technical changes.
Okay.
But yeah, we will see when they go out for official comment. What objections there might be.
Any other questions? Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the adoption of completed Rule Review 7, TAC Part 8, Chapter 151, concerning home equity lending procedures, Chapter 152, concerning repair, renovation, and new construction on homestead property, and Chapter 153, concerning home equity lending?
I'll move.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion is adopted. We'll move on to discussion of and possible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comments of amendment to 7 TAC Part 8, Chapter 153, concerning home equity lending resulting from rule review. This is found in the Finance Commission section, page 33.
If there are any other questions about the proposals, I'd be happy to answer them. But yeah, again, the proposed amendments are the ones I laid out a second ago. If there are any questions about those, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC Part 8, Chapter 153, concerning home equity lending resulting from rule review?
So moved.
Thank
Second.
You. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted. Thank you. Items number 9, 10, and 11 will be deferred and addressed in executive session. So with that, we will move on to the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, which is on page 42. Caroline?
Yes, certainly. On page 42, the chart A, as you'll recall, the first three charts are ones that we intend to have regularly in the packets until or unless you all prefer something else. Then the next three charts are charts that we're currently focused on. So for chart A, the message from this chart is that capital is good in the thrift industry. Thrifts are growing, and they're taking on more risk, but they are managing that risk. On the solid line on that chart, it shows an increase of aggregate assets to $15 billion as of 3/31/16. Comparing that to a year before, aggregate assets were $11.2 billion at that point. The median state savings bank is $316 million, compared to a year ago when it was $285 million. The dotted line indicates risk-based capital that has declined somewhat. This is due to growth, particularly growth in the commercial real estate and commercial loan area. However, on the dash line, the median Tier 1 leverage capital shows us that Tier 1 is basically stable. On chart B, non-performing assets continue to be low. The net interest margin, or the profit margin, is relatively unchanged from the same quarter in 2015. There's, that's sufficient unless you all have comments or questions. On page 43, long-term asset exposures. Thrifts, I said this last time and I'll probably say it next time, thrifts make long-term assets, residential mortgage loans. So we are particularly concerned with interest rate rising and how that could affect the exposure of thrifts. As of now, the last speech that Chair Yellen made indicated that there will not be an interest rate rise in the June meeting of the Federal Reserve, and so we're still waiting to see when and how much interest will rise. We always focus on interest rate, and we will just continue to because it is inherent in a thrift charter. On chart D, construction concentrations, the guidance says if it's over 100% of capital, construction concentrations require some additional regulatory reporting and such. The top quartile of the thrifts in Texas are at 121%, which is up from the same time last year. But if you look at the median in the thrift industry is 40%, which is way below the guidelines. And even with the outliers, they appear to us to be managing their risk, identifying and managing the risk appropriately. Chart E on page 44, liquidity risk. So liquidity risk for Texas thrifts is increasing. If you look at the net non-core funding dependency ratio, that shows that the median has increased from a negative 1.61 a year ago to 2.16 in this year. Another indicator of liquidity risk is the loan-to-deposit ratio, which has also increased slightly. So based on those levels, the liquidity is a particular focus at our exams and our off-site review. We've expanded our early detection model to include an additional liquidity risk factor. Having said all that, we know which banks are taking the risk in liquidity, and we know why. And so they are. We're in contact with those particular banks. It's not a, I don't want to overstate the concern, but it is something that we are watching in particular during our exams and off-site. So, chart F, we continue to have no 3, 4, or 5 rated thrifts. And then with regard to all of the above matters and issues, these are things that, of course, we're looking at exams and then off-site, both at our quarterly monitoring and then as particular issues come up at particular banks. So, We have sent out our Save the Date for Thrift Day in September, and we're very pleased that our external speaker this year will be Sanjay Basin, who is the president and CEO of the Federal Home Loan Bank in Dallas. And of course, you all will be invited to attend. So. Do y'all have any questions about thrifts before I move to mortgage? Okay. On the mortgage side, the current licensing population is in the chart and the materials. What I want to do is give you a sense of what they were a year ago and what changes have taken place. So with entities and branches, there's been a slight increase. With the individual mortgage loan originators, there's a 19% increase in the amount of originators in Texas that are under our jurisdiction. On the applications that have been approved to date, this year there's been a 16% increase. So, on the mortgage exam side, both on mortgage exams and mortgage complaints, at the time the packets were sent out, we weren't able to have the through the third quarter figures. So in the book, in the materials, they go through the first half of 16. I'm going to update you to where they are now as of May 31st, 16. So for exams, during the first three quarters, we conducted a total of 393 full-scope exams, which covered 4,743 mortgage loan originators. And that same time last year, we had done 297 exams covering 6,573 originators. That's because in 15, we examined some very large mortgage companies, and so they each have a high number of originators. Whereas this year, we knew that in our cycle, we would have more smaller companies, therefore fewer originators. All of that was anticipated and is not surprising to us. Consumer complaints. During the first half of 16, we received, during up to May 31st, all three quarters, we've received 840 consumer complaints, which is a 25% increase when compared to the same time last year. And we still continue to see loan servicing complaints represent 60% of the total number of those complaints. And that has held true since about 2012. We received jurisdiction from the legislature over mortgage servicers 2011, and we anticipated that those complaints would become the largest percentage, and that has continued for several years now. General Counsel Garcia has been fulfilling some state guard duties this week, but his report is in the packet, and I'm going to make comments on a couple of places. As you can tell, we have several upcoming hearings at SOA. We did report two gifts. The first was a complimentary registration fee in the amount of $945 for one of our examiners to attend the Armour Spring Training School. And then I received a complimentary registration fee in the value of $725 to attend the Texas Bankers Association annual convention. We continue to work on several mortgage investigations that have drawn some legislative and media attention, so I want you all to know that those are ongoing, and we are in collaboration with the Attorney General's office on those matters. So, on page 47, one other item on the law, pending litigation, Catherine Sims versus SML, the AG's office did file an answer on the department's behalf on April 7th. Other items. I told y'all at the last meeting that the CSBS Armour accreditation team had been in March. We did receive our reaccreditation. We were originally accredited in 2011 and were one of the first nine states to be accredited on the mortgage non-depository area. So we were very pleased to see that our mortgage program has again been found to meet the standards and expectations set out by that program. And I want to thank several of our people because that reaccreditation process, it's an audit, it's an exam, and so we do spend a lot of time and resources getting things ready and being in communication with the team. And Tony Florence, our director of mortgage exam, wave your hand, Tony, was very instrumental in that reaccreditation process, but also heavy weight is given in that process to exams and complaints, and he and his team do an excellent job of holding us to the level of service and work and efficiencies that we have for ourselves. And then along with his area, they look in depth at licensing, so Stephen O'Shields and his team, and also at our operations, at Antonia's finance and operation area. So I think it reminds us all that some of us work very directly with the industry. Some of our support, though, in the office from our infrastructure is equally important, and this reaccreditation is to her credit as well. So thank you all and your staffs for what you do. So agency operations, we had two planned retirements that occurred, one in spring and one late May. One was an investigator. We knew early on that she would be retiring, and so in November, we hired another investigator for overlap and training purposes. So that retirement took place. I'm going to call her the successor investigator is still there. So, on the legal side, we had a planned retirement for late May, and so we hired another attorney last October, again for succession and training and overlap purposes. As it turned out, the planned retirement retired in the end of May, and the successor attorney for personal reasons also left. So we have offered a position to an attorney who's accepted, and we'll start in a couple of weeks. I expect in August you'll meet our new attorney at the Finance Commission then. So. And the rules were on the consent agenda. But that's my report. I'm happy to answer any questions.
If I might just echo, as we talked about at the beginning of the meeting, the regard that our agencies are held at the federal level is just exemplary. And in addition to Charles' service and the CFPB director being in to meet with us and the SML's accreditation, this is just another example. And I just want to commend Caroline and the agency for the reaccreditation and being an example and leading by example. Okay, moving on, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, which is found on page 63. Leslie?
Yes, thank you. So our report begins 63-64. First, though, before I go over some of the material that we presented to you, I wanted to mention a very important regulatory development that happened last week on June the 2nd. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced their notice of proposed rulemaking on rules related to payday loans and auto title loans. And so the rule sets out, first of all, the rule proposal document is 1,300 pages. And so we're still working our way through and analyzing the proposal. But it certainly takes a broad approach to a number of issues related to payday loans and short-term loans. It really bifurcates the proposal into loans less than 30 days and then longer installment loans. There's a large focus on ability to repay as it relates to loans and dealing with loans that fall into a cycle of debt. So those are some disclosure issues that accompany that. So there's a lot of particular issues that we're focused on in the rulemaking looking at. One of the items I wanted to mention to you and just comment on, there's in the rule proposal, there is reference to a supplemental report in which they evaluate a number of issues, including they highlight a provision about Texas and the effect of the disclosure that the Finance Commission adopted in 2012 when we first began regulating some of this activity. And they talk about the impact that disclosure, they've done some research and tried to ascertain what impact that disclosure had upon the marketplace. And so there's some interesting research there, but it's interesting to see that they highlighted the effect, and they did find in that study that the disclosure had some effect. It appeared that they were trying to neutralize some other variables, but it said that the disclosure the Finance Commission adopted did have some positive effect on consumers, it appeared, in terms of their behavior related to payday loans. So I thought that was very interesting. So we'll further I mean, we'll continue to evaluate this and look at this. The other, obviously, concern and issue that we are studying very closely is what happens and how do we deal with issues where the proposal may be inconsistent with state laws or municipal ordinances. And again, we're trying to understand what those points of inconsistencies might be and how would those be resolved. The information that's provided in the proposal says that you know, all of those provisions should be able to be read together in harmony, and then any provision that has a more protective effect on a consumer would be the one that prevails. But there's still questions about what creates greater protection for a consumer, a required principal pay down in 3 payments or a required principal pay down in 4 payments, you know, and so we don't know which one of those is viewed as being more protective. So there's a number of issues that we certainly are still trying to wrap our heads around, and we'll continue to study that. But that's a very significant development for in this particular area, so we'll be pretty involved.
Can I comment on that?
Sure, absolutely.
With the CFPB rules, Commissioner Prettyjohn, the other thing that's on the forecast that I think the commission needs to be aware of is the Military Lending Act coming up in October. And with this overlap, it's going to create such a dry desert out there for financial products for the military and their dependents. And this is a hard cap of 36%, which is concerning. And as a member of the commission, I just want everyone else to be aware that all the military bases in our state are going to be heavily impacted by this. And so we need to be prepared for what will be the next shoe to drop from that. And that kind of dovetails with the CFPB, but this is concerning to the consumer credit side of the business. And I certainly hope that we can help our military and their families find a way through this.
What did the 36% relate to?
It's an interest rate cap to all military lending and their dependents.
And it's a differently defined interest rate cap because it's sort of an all-in. It includes all fees and interest.
They're loading everything into that number.
And so typically you would think, well, that, you know, that's still a high number, and that's an argument from a different day and a different place, but that's going to significantly impact. And I was in Killeen earlier this week, and I think when you look around at the number of military loans that are made safe and affordably in Texas now with this new federal regulation that's piled on, it's going to be a tremendous impact on Texans.
Are they primarily short-term loans?
Most of them.
There's certainly a great availability of short-term loans around a number of military bases.
So there, my sense is, and I'll probably get the terminology wrong, but my sense is there is either a DOD-related or some other organization which focuses on making those sorts of loans. Are they a target of this legislative effort? And I may have completely misconstrued that.
Mr. Plunkett, there's really not another product in the marketplace right now. The DOD feels like there's a Military Relief Act in place, some of the on-base outlets, mm-hmm. but that's not a realistic view mm-hmm. in the opinion of industry.
So this is one of those sort of unintended consequence sort of mm-hmm. things that
yes.
you think you're protecting people, and in fact what you do is you eliminate choices for products and services available for consumers, and so what do they do?
Exactly. And I would just challenge, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would just challenge the members of the commission to be prepared for a number of military families to come before us and say, what do I do now for a lending option?
So I'd like to make a comment related to that. So some people believe that this will result in a reduction in availability of credit. One of the things that Director Cordray has stated publicly and privately is that it was his hope that the banks would come back into the small dollar loan market. And that is going to be very hard for the banks to do because the federal agencies, primarily the FDIC, has drummed the banks out of this market, where they used to make small dollar loans in order to serve the public and the community, and they've been beat over the head so much that they're not able to do it now. And unless there's a change in that attitude, the banks won't be able to help fill the void. Very, very troublesome.
Leslie, we may not have a practice, but do we anticipate providing comments from the agency or through some regulatory trade association, if that's a term?
Right, it is a term. And often we will participate with of the regulatory trade associations and providing comment to rules. I'm not sure it may be appropriate for this rule. We may provide our own comment because I think it's going to be difficult. States are going to have a little different perspective on a number of the issues related to this rule. So we're, again, we'll be evaluating what's the appropriate way. But we've been asked very directly that they definitely are interested in feedback from the states on the rules. So we'll certainly provide that in some form or fashion.
And so the process for that would be you would draft comments and would we have an opportunity to look at them before you sent them, or what's the...
That's typically not how that's worked. The agencies have done that, but if members have a particular interest, I'm happy to work with the members on you know, a draft of those comments prior to our submission.
You know, this is very similar to when the CFPB came out with the TILA regulation and rules, which were over 1,800 pages. And, of course, there's always unintended consequences. And with respect to mortgage credit, in which case it came down in a very restrictive manner, it definitely limited the mortgage markets. There are many different entities, from banks to small thrifts to mortgage companies, who exited the marketplace over the regulation that came down. And most of the commentary that came up to the CFPB came from the trade groups. So I would encourage the trade groups, as I'm sure you all are already on top of it, to be prepared to comment. In the case of the mortgage rules, we have gotten some extremely limited relief, but not much. The CFPB doesn't really answer to anybody, and they come out with their rules, and we get them. But certainly, you know, as we digest this, you know, certainly the trade groups do want to comment.
Thank you for that. Let me make that comment.
Well, I mean, I appreciate you bringing up the issue on military lending, and I did want to mention that we will have some rules in the next meeting where we need to change a few things in the pawn area so that they're able to comply with the Military Lending Act. So there'll be some record keeping kind of changes. So we'll have some proposed rules we'll be bringing the next meeting. So we'll have more opportunity to talk about Military Lending Act at the next meeting as well. So. Okay. Okay, with that, I think I'll turn to some information in your report. On page 64, we start with information related to our examinations. Excuse me, and this is for the period from September through April, the 8-month window there, and you'll see our performance for an examination thus far. We've continued to concentrate our efforts on motor vehicle sales finance, and you can see year-over-year comparison, our activity is up 55% over the prior year. So we've certainly spent some extensive effort in that area, and I think that's where we felt it's appropriate to target our resources. We know that we have some persistent areas of compliance, non-compliance we're trying to get to, and I think, you know, those results are bearing out. a little bit further down, the memo talks about staffing related to examinations, and we finished one class. We've got a new class beginning on June 13th, next week, and with the staffing of that class, we will our examiner ranks will be fully staffed starting next week, which we haven't seen in a little while, so we're pleased to be back in that posture, and we're starting to see results already from the next class. acceptable compliance on the bottom of page 65. I did want to note, while we're still realize we've got some significant work to do, and really the last three columns, motor vehicle sales finance, property tax, and credit access businesses, we have seen some pretty good, some improvement in property tax levels of compliance and credit access businesses. We hope that we'll continue to see some improvement, but I'm not sure I'm super optimistic for a lot of improvement before the end of the fiscal year. A lot of this just has to do, I mean, we've laid out some of the reasons why, as we are trying to deal with some bringing people into compliance with some recently adopted rules. We're doing a lot more in this enterprise, what I'm calling enterprise level examinations, and so sometimes non-compliance issues get magnified over the calculation, but I think it all means is that, you know, we are spending our efforts in the areas where it matters, and, you know, we're certainly putting all of our efforts behind making sure that we're bringing folks back into compliance as best we can.
So Leslie, let's focus on the CAD number for a second.
Okay.
And So, my eyes are better. So it looks like 49% of the enterprises were able to comply, mm-hmm. which means 51% didn't. And, you know, we should compliment the 49% who complied. Sorry. But if I was in that group, I'd be slightly irritated that I spent the effort to comply. You know, I did the things we needed to do to make sure my business complied with the regulations, and my competitors didn't.
Right.
So it seems to me those competitors didn't comply might, you know, might have a competitive advantage, because why would they comply? So I have this vision of the compliance officer and this group that did comply sitting in and talking to his chief executive officer and saying, we need to do this, and the chief executive officer saying, why? Half the industry doesn't comply. So what incentive do the folks who didn't comply have to comply when they didn't and the other half did?
Well, some of the incentive is they're not having to spend significant company resources going through a complete self-review of every single account to cure or modify the account to correct those violations. That's a fairly, it's a burden on companies that have to go through that process and then have to make refunds or restitution on the accounts that have those kinds of problems. So I would hope that's the negative incentive is enough to force them towards compliance. We've had some persistent issues that I think we've really been clearing a number of complex exam issues that I'm hopeful we're going to see this number bounce back up in the next year after we get some of these difficult issues cleared out of the way. But I think we've made good progress on those issues.
Once again, I want to renew my request that we do a chart like at the top of the first.
Yes.
On the next page.
Yes.
For cabs and for property tax lenders. I asked for this last time.
I'm so sorry.
And so that we can have a longitudinal report to see, you know, I'm very pleased, you know, we have another dip down with the motor vehicle sales, but the compliance has gone up dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Kudos to the industry for doing that. But we need to have the same sort of careful review so we can get the picture of that going forward.
Yes. We will do that. And we've been talking about a little bit further analysis, because I anticipated that we would have some questions about this, a little further analysis about some of the reasons for the noncompliance, and more specifically in property tax and cap for your next report.
That'd be good, thanks.
What's your cycle on exams for them?
Well, it's a risk-based cycle that we, Rudy, you want to come forward and talk a little bit about there's a risk-based methodology that we use to assess these examinations, so it's not it doesn't count by months in particular, but there's some average times, and Rudy can probably shed some further light on cycle times.
So, I'm sorry, Paul, but your specific, Rudy Aguilar, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, and your specific question,
it's Jay's question, yeah. About the cycle of the...
What's the cycle, exam cycle for CAB?
In CAB, we have put a tool in place that is bringing up the most the highest risk entities. And so that's sort of turning the whole situation a little bit. That initially we had a projection of about 36 months. Okay, so we're still going to sort of look at that, but we are using a tool now that takes some quantitative information, and we see what rises to the top. Then we match against resources that are available, the regional locations. We also are doing an approach of examination that I believe is being more fruitful as far as efficiency, in the sense of we try to approach enterprises or groups and do the whole group at once if possible. Some groups are so big that we have to cut them up a little bit, but that's one of the reasons that we're getting some of the swings in and Paul in the acceptable level of compliance, because we'll take a whole group.
Rudy, are you saying that your tool has been successful, and that because of the risk weighting that you're actually finding the riskiest?
That is one of the factors. The other I would bring up, the commission was just talking about, we had some positions in which we had folks engaged in certain activities in which they would disagree with us in the sense of whether it was a violation or not. And so in that we engaged in, you know, discussions, and I think we're finally getting some solutions in some of those situations and moving forward. But in those, some of those, we had people in that 4-rated category, and I think out of some of the solutions we're reaching, they will come out of that, out of the final solution to those things. And in many places, you know, they have essentially, we have prevailed and we're getting people to change some practices that I think needed to be changed. But there was some long discussions in some of that.
I would make the assumption that your 4 and 5s get rated more often than 36 months.
If it's got a pending 4 or 5 rated exam, yes, that's one of the weighting factors that brings that one up.
Okay.
Yes. Because that's an unacceptable.
Months, 6 to 12 months after.
Okay. Right. So
that's another reward, I guess, you get for being compliant.
That's true. You don't have to go through an exam.
Definite
reward. So those factors you can see, as Paul was pointing out, in tax lien lending and in the credit access business exam functions, we are trying to do these exams in groups or enterprise approaches, so that we can, you know, get the whole group in there. Now, the other factor in tax lien lending is that's a pretty small group. I think that's less than 90 licensees right now. So when we do a group that has quite a few, you know, locations licensed in it, it'll cause a swing. So we're still looking at, obviously, those intervals, but this exam tool, we're using it to quantitatively measure risk and help us focus on those places.
When you guys have someone that's way out of compliance, is there steps, like, for example, in banking, a memorandum of understanding and stuff where they're very getting close to being closed?
Well, we'll have that examination report with special instructions in it and a short cycle response time, normally about 90 days. And if it's a complex issue, they'll ask for extensions. And it's not unusual for us to go 180 days to maybe a year on a complex issue. And then we'll actually go back when we've, you know, reached whatever the solution is, whether we are convinced that maybe something needs to be altered as far as our approach. And that happens.
But
sometimes, but not that
often. But there's certain issues, if they don't get resolved through the examination, through that process, they'll get escalated to legal, and legal will have, they have a bevy of tools. I mean, they have
so it's administrative action, but we try to encourage people to deal with issues in the exam process, because that's a confidential process. When you go to legal and we get an administrative process, now you sort of coming out into the public access information area.
Okay. Thank you, Rudy. So on page 66, some information about investigations, and as of April, we've already completed what would be our year-end target for investigations. So clearly we're going to be over target on those types of investigations. Again, motor vehicle sales finance is our large area and investigations. So, but we'll continue to work through those. On page 67, a complaints process, again, are running ahead of where we were last year as well. Again, motor vehicle sales finance is our large area there. We've seen about 28% growth in complaints resolved from the prior year, and those comprise over half of the complaints that we resolve are in the motor vehicle sales finance. We'll note that the cab complaints are down slightly from the prior year. Interesting observation. Moving to page 69 is information that we report the statistical data from the quarterly reports that the credit access businesses provide to us. And so you're looking at a first quarter comparison. Similar trends continue as we see movement into multiple installment loans, and we've also, you see the comment at the top that we continue to see some decline in the number of stores, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the licensing chart, but over the last 4 years, that number's about a third of what it was previously. You'll see the number, the multiple installment loans for on payday loans and on title loans, that the average loan amounts continue to creep up a little bit higher, so larger loans are being made. However, the average fee, unit cost fee, has declined slightly, some very slightly in the auto title case, though, in the first quarter.
Leslie, do we have a view into what percentage of the cab loans are in default?
That is not a data field that we currently collect. And default varies from company to company. We've had a lot of discussions with stakeholders about how to capture that. And I think it's still an important statistic that we need to consider, but we're, as of yet, it's been a difficult issue, but it's something that we've been having conversations about, whether or not to capture that. Page 70 begins the licensing report, and just noting that we're currently in the renewal cycle for both pawn shops and for motor vehicle sales finance. Our licensing team has continued to make some great improvements in the licensing process, and our applications, number of pending applications continues to improve. Interesting note, though, that the total business applications that we received in March and April is down about 25%, so we're seeing a little bit of leveling off of the heightened activity we've had fairly well sustained over the last couple of years. So we'll continue to monitor to those issues. We do note here industry development. Most of you have probably heard this, but at the bottom of page 70, that on April the 28th, a merger agreement was announced to merge First Cash Financial Services and Cash America International, and that those two companies hold, you know, fairly significant number of licenses in Texas, as well as, you know, the combined company is going to have a significant footprint across the U.S. and even into other countries. On page 71 is the dashboard of our licensing entities, and if you note on the licensee count on the upper left, the number of motor vehicle sales finance companies is at a new record, over 9,000 licensed locations. We also see, you see a tick up there between the quarter two and just quarter three to date, we're not all the way through quarter three, on the regulated lenders, that those continue to increase the number of regulated lender locations. And so that's where we're seeing some offset growth to the decline in credit access businesses. Those held stable so far over this last quarter, but we've said they've been continuing to decline over time. So we're kind of seeing those two trends diverge there. And then I guess the only other comment I'd make is on the bottom right, when you pull all the regulated individuals and entities together, the new high water mark of 36,282 licenses and registrations. So that's a lot of folks out there. Let's see. Certainly, moving on, there's information and communication, a lot of detailed information on HR if you have any questions about that. I do want to note on page 74 that we've welcomed Jessica Salazar to be our new financial literacy and communication specialist, and we're excited about the talents that Jessica brings, and we look forward to reinvigorating some efforts in our financial education and literacy effort. She'll also be working on the financial endowment education program as well, so we're pleased to have her aboard. And on page 75, we've got some updates for you on our information technology project, and we continue with the development of that. And the first module relating to our documentary feeds is, we anticipate we'll be able to go live sometime in the next 2 weeks with the online documentary feed, hopefully by the end of next week, but we're working quickly on that particular module. And then other modules will be rolling out. Target dates for those are in mid-August for the consumer complaint modules and the investigation modules. The exam module is going to be one of the larger components of this particular project, and we're looking at a fall launch sometime in the fall for the examination module. We're currently in the process. We just received the final use cases from our developer, and staff are working through the final use cases to sign off on those. Legal report begins on page 76. There's information there on two SOA cases, cases that have gone before SOA, in which we've received the proposals for decision. In one case, based upon some of the testimony that was provided, the second case, we determined to that we should go ahead and grant the application. We'd initially denied it, but there was additional evidence presented, so we closed the action and granted the application. I would point out on page 78, just so you know, that we've currently, year to date, looking at 264 enforcement actions that we've closed, so we certainly have a continued high level of activity. I'll also note the little bullet points below the chart that we've opened 130 cases in order to issue administrative injunctions, and that's a fairly large number. It's a little bit of a change in our process relating to based upon, you know, some evolution of our administrative process, based upon some of the testimony and some of the cases and some of the decisions, we've begun to use this process of administrative injunctions before as the initial element in a particular case. And so that's just a little bit of change. We'll kind of see how that works over time, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And then on page 80, I wanted to note on the Property Tax Lender Truth in Lending Act litigation and the Billings versus Propel Financial Services, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals announced their decision in that case, and they held that a property tax loan does not constitute an extension of credit that would be subject to the Truth in Lending Act, because of the transfer of the existing tax obligation does not create new debt. So that is an important issue, as we've been talking about in the past, that we've been following and monitoring, and that certainly will have some potential impact to this industry. We met with the industry and talked about this issue a little bit and what types of anticipated impact we might see. If the decision stands, we need to allow the decision to certainly play out until, you know, we'll await a final decision and exhaustion of all appeals. But if the decision stands, we'll need to reevaluate the rules as it relates to disclosure of cost and fees related to property tax. That's sort of an immediate issue we see. So we may be bringing that back to the commission if the decision stands as it is today. So just wanted to make you aware of that. And then lastly, I wanted to point out that we, you know, at the last meeting, the commission adopted the rule on the documentary fees, and we have issued a legal bulletin on compliance with the new effective date of June the 1st and how to file documentary fee submissions. And we'll be amending that probably here in the next week or two as the new system becomes available, but certainly we've been trying to keep stakeholders informed about how to remain in compliance relative to that. I'll be happy to answer any questions on any of the operations issues. If not, I think we're ready to go to rules, and I'd like to invite Matt Nasley to go forward.
Before we do that, just two things. Firstly, just wanted to make a comment on page 72. I can't remember the last time that I read your report and saw seven positions filled for financial examiners. So I commend you for that. That is certainly only going to help compliance figures, and so that's a great accomplishment. And then secondly, Chairman's prerogative, might I announce that at this time the Finance Commission is going to take a 10-minute recess. And the time would be 10:17. I now reconvene this meeting of the Finance Commission pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. The time is 10:31. Leslie, if we could move on to item 5?
C5, yes. And I'd like to call upon Matt Nance to lay out the rule proposal.
Good morning, Matt Nance, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. This rule action is item C5. This is a proposal for regulated lender rule review, and it starts on page 103. The rules all relate to consumer loans that the OCCC regulates under Chapter 342 of the Finance Code. The rules deal mainly with licensing and technical corrections and updates. For licensing, we have several changes similar to some amendments that the Commission previously adopted for credit access businesses in December and for motor vehicle dealers in April. They relate to issues like maintaining updated contact information, license transfers, and criminal history. We also have some technical corrections and updates, and the one I wanted to address has to do with the Military Lending Act. As Commissioner Holt summarized earlier, the Department of Defense recently amended its Military Lending Act rule, and we are amending our rule, our record-keeping rule, to put lenders on notice about records we would expect them to maintain under the Military Lending Act. So, again, as we discussed earlier, the Department of Defense recently amended the Military Lending Rule. Previously, their rule only applied to short-term payday loans, title loans, and refund anticipation loans. But starting October 3rd of this year, most consumer lenders are going to be subject to the rule, except for residential mortgage lenders and lenders who finance the purchase of an automobile. The amended Department of Defense Military Lending Rule applies when lenders make a consumer loan to a covered military borrower, which means active duty service members and their dependents. And when a lender makes a loan to one of those borrowers, the rule has a disclosure requirement and a maximum military APR of 36%. The MAPR is similar to APR, but it has a slightly different calculation that includes things like credit insurance premiums. So as part of this rule action, we are updating the record-keeping requirements so that lenders would maintain two different kinds of records. First of all, any information they get about whether a borrower is a covered borrower under the Military Lending Act rule, there's a database that they can consult, and the Department of Defense's rule allows them to maintain those records as proof that they complied with the rule, and then also any disclosures they provide. So those are the record-keeping amendments we have related to the Military Lending Rule. As far as the process for this rule, we sent out a pre-comment draft on May 4th. We held a stakeholder meeting here in the building on May 20th. We got one informal written pre-comment with some thoughts about the license transfer rule, and we were able to incorporate some of those concepts into the rule. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments, new rules, and repeals in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 83, Subchapter A, concerning rules for regulated lenders?
So moved.
Will?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion is adopted. Item 6. Discussion of and possible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comment of amendments and a new rule in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 87, concerning tax refund anticipation loans resulting from rule review.
So this is item C6. This is a proposal for rule review amendments for refund anticipation loans, and it starts on page 120. The rules relate to companies that facilitate tax refund anticipation loans, which the OCCC registers and regulates under Chapter 352 of the Finance Code. The rules clarify a few issues on the registration process for facilitators. They explain a registration expires on December 31st, and they also explain that a registrant, if they're going to register late after they've started doing business, they have to pay a $250 late filing fee. The $250 fee is provided by Section 349.302 of the Finance Code, which sets out late filing fees for companies that register with the OCCC. The rules also require companies to give consumers a written notice with the OCCC's contact information so they know how to file a complaint with the OCCC. And they can provide that disclosure on either their privacy notices or their fee disclosures. The fee disclosures are already required under the Finance Code, but this requires them to provide a notice so that consumers know to how to file a complaint with our office. We sent out a pre-comment draft on May 9th. We held a stakeholder meeting on May 23rd, and it was actually our first online go-to meeting, rule stakeholder meeting, where we had streaming audio and a PowerPoint where people could log on, hear audio of the meeting, and see a presentation of the rule. We actually didn't have anyone coming in person to the meeting, but we did get several people who watched, or I should say listened, online. And then we didn't get any informal written pre-comments on the amendments. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about this proposal, and if not, we recommend the commission publish the rules for comment.
It's good to hear that that was done in a go-to meeting format,
yeah,
which I would think would invite more participation for those who can't come, so that was,
I think so,
good progress. We're getting with
that's
the program.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 87, concerning tax refund anticipation loans resulting from rule review?
I move.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion is adopted. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members. That concludes our report.
Thank you. We'll move on to Charles, the Department of Banking, and that starts on page 127.
Okay, if you'll turn to 128, the first report at the top of the page, as we always talk about, you'll see that the number of banks, you'll see the number continues to decline. We're down to 250. The assets that they control, though, increases. Now, this is the number of banks. Since we primarily regulate community banks, this is a nationwide trend that is a little bit troubling, and we're trying to deal with that. But at least in our case, our banks are small, getting small. The number's getting smaller, but the size is getting bigger. You will see down at the bottom chart, the problem banks, those rated 3, 4, or 5, we've got down to 7. We're now up to 8. The stress created by the energy sector will cause that number to increase. With crude at over 50, it puts a little bit of relief, I believe, but the service, our banks generally do not finance producers. Some of them do, but it's not widespread. They do finance service companies. And service companies would be a lag. At $50, I read something yesterday, $50, or actually at $45, the equity guys come back into the market, and at $50, so they're beginning to come back in the market. We hear, I read that some rigs are being put back to work in the Permian Basin, and so, but for the servicing industry, that lags, and so whether that's sustainable, I believe there'll be more pressure on our banks that deal in this. As we told you before, we have an intense review of the banks. I think we've got about 25 banks, Bob, that are heavy into the direct and indirect exposure, and then we have another 25 or 26 that we're closely monitoring. I've been, quite frankly, well pleased at the way our banks have responded to this downturn. Lessons learned, I think, from the past has gone a long way, but there is stress, and I believe that stress will continue for this year anyway. On 29 at the bottom of the page, let me say that the administrative orders are basically flat at 22. We have 22 outstanding administrative orders. At the bottom chart, everything is okay. We are behind on our trust company examinations. Average late is 14 days. That's primarily because of some turnover. We've hired some new folks. It just takes a little bit to get them up to speed where they can fully participate. On top of 130, top talks about the energy exposure, oil and gas analysis. I want to mention at the second bullet point, the examination tool suite. This is a program that's basically being led by the FDIC, but we have primarily Kevin Wu, who's one of our review examiners, has participated significantly in that program, and that will become the tool that all examiners across the country will use. I also mentioned down at the bottom on it shows the things that we've been doing, but down at the bottom we had another meeting of our employee advisory council, which is a cross section of our employees, examiners, people working headquarters, administrative staff. We meet periodically with them. They give us recommendations. As an example, last bullet point, we started a program where we bring examiners into the field to work as temporary review examiners here in the office, where they can learn a little bit about what we do. It helps, I think, on possibly in our management program, and also gives them just general information about what goes on. So I think it's a good program, and that came out of the recommendation of the employees council. Beginning on page 132 and 133 would be the corporate division activities, which is primarily the applications. Applications, generally speaking, are down. It does point out that we lost two banks due to mergers with national banks, and they're mentioned there. We did last week, which will be our next meeting report, we did approve a national charter converting to state charter. And it's somewhat interesting. We've had, I think, an increase in inquiries from national banks about converting to state charter. So I think the quality of our program is being recognized, and some people are considering conversion.
Charles, can I ask one question? Are you getting any interest in new bank charters? You know how they kind of started?
Yes, good question. Thank you, Molly. Yes. There's still the question was about new bank charters. We have not officially had an application, but I've continued to be told that one is in the works. I believe that they will come. There won't be many, but if there's an economic reason for a bank to be started in a rural area, but not an urban area, I think that maybe we'll see some. Now, I believe I talked, the FDIC says that they're going to be kinder, gentler on the application process for insurance. That remains to be seen. But they say they will. But in our case, and in Caroline's case, if somebody files a charter, they have to file with us. And then if we think it's good, we'll move forward. If we think it's not good, then we won't. On special audits, the numbers, I would say, generally remain consistent. On page 135, it talks about the activity for the division. They always have a lot of activity going on. We'll mention that on May the 12th, the prepaid funeral guarantee fund advisory committee met here in Austin. And we had Stephanie. We had one new member in that committee. So they have to approve certain claims before we can pay out from the fund, and that's their job. Beginning on page 136 and 137, and carrying over the It's about the consumer, the complaints, and also the inquiries, and just generally speaking, just because of passage of time, the numbers have gone up. There's not anything in there that I would consider extraordinary, other than I believe that our folks that handle the complaints that work for Wendy Rodriguez do an extraordinary job of, you know, I think I told y'all before, but we don't just say, well, that's not our area of responsibility. That's done by Baba, whoever it is. We try to put them in contact with the right people so that their response will be answered, and we follow up on that. The on page 140 about I want to mention the second bullet point from the bottom. Financial education. April was the National Financial Literacy Month, and there was the various activities. We have the coordinator, the Lonnie Lymphagus, that participated in all these events. Greater Financial Fitness Greater Austin was one of them, and Lolani coordinated the Smart Kid Essay Contest. Information is there, and there was a kind of a ceremony, and Deputy Commissioner Bob Bacon provided the opening remarks for that group. And then the last bullet point on that page, and the bullet points of page 141, talk about our hits on our website. Kind of interesting on the numbers on the hits. And so for that, for our activity report and everything, before Catherine comes up, any questions on that? It's more of the same, primarily. Catherine, you want to come up and give a legal update?
Good morning, members. Catherine Ryer, General Counsel, Texas Department of Banking. On page 142 of your materials, you'll see the legal division update. There are just a couple of items on here that I wanted to mention specifically. The first one deals with State of Texas versus House Savings Investment. This is a receivership that was established following the failure of one of our licensed entities that had provided a biweekly payment service. The update that occurred following the preparation of this memo was that the checks have now been actually distributed to the former customers of the failed entity. So that is good news, and the receivership should be winding down. There's a process outlined that was approved by the court for the initial distribution of funds that were available. It is pennies on the dollar, unfortunately, was all that was left. The assets that were recovered by the receiver, but at least the customers are receiving some money. There's a process for distributing those funds, as I said, that was approved by the court. There's a certain time period within which those checks have to be cashed. If they are not cashed within that time period, I believe it's 60 days, then the remaining funds are recaptured and redistributed to the former customers that did participate in the first round. So. Good news that it's winding down. Disappointing that, as I said, it's pennies on the dollar, but that is what the court approved. That is what the receiver was able to find in the way of assets. The second thing I wanted to mention is our agency did receive one gift since the last Finance Commission meeting, and that was registration fee valued at $725 for Commissioner Cooper to attend the TBA annual convention May 4th through 6th in Grapevine. On the second page of the memo, I wanted to mention that there was another order issued, again, following preparation of the memo. This was a second order that we've issued. Actually, I think it's maybe now the fourth order that we've issued against one of our former licensees. It was IntelliPayment, so a money service business, and basically the order just assessed an additional administrative penalty based on later information that we got from them concerning the number of customers, the number of transactions that were conducted while they did not hold a license. And I believe the fine there was about $15,000. So those were the only things I wanted to mention specifically, but if you have any other questions, I'm happy to address them.
I think the only question I have is, with respect to the money services business, there is no kind of fund like there is in the prepaid funerals or in mortgage lending or anything. Is there potentially some future thought to, if you see a lot of action in this area, that maybe part of a fee might go to some sort of recovery fund?
I have never even thought of that, but I suppose that could be something that...
Just if there's some pervasive action that continues, it might be a thought for the future.
We are, this summer, we are starting our internal discussions about potential legislative ideas. So if I can definitely throw that into the mix as an item for discussion. I've never researched it. I've never even thought of it. So it could be possible. It could be something good.
Okay. So,
okay. So items 2 through 7 were on the consent agenda. So that takes us to item 8, which is discussion of and possible vote to take action on the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC 11.37 concerning complaint notices, which is found on page 161. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
You didn't get to go very far.
I thought you were
coming back.
Good morning again. The last item in your packet on page 161 is an amendment to 7 TAC section 1137 concerning complaint notices. The rule currently states that our banks must provide notices to customers concerning how and where they can file a complaint. We're suggesting a very minor change to allow the wording of the rule so that the language of the notices must substantially conform to the prescribed text included in the rule. We're suggesting this change to provide an opportunity for the banks to notify customers in a way that's clear and fits the context of the notice. I have a couple of examples if you're interested. The prescribed language of the notice states that if you'll turn to, I guess this is page 160, two of your packet. For example, the prescribed language says the and then your name is chartered, licensed, or registered under the laws of the state of Texas. Some of our licensees, such as Frost Bank, have taken it so literally that they say the Frost Bank, but that's not actually the name of the bank. So the change here that we're proposing is really just to allow those very minor changes to the wording that is published so that it, as I say, so that it can flow. Another example is some of our banks actually have a money service business license as well, and there's a separate notice that's required for money service businesses. So this would allow them to actually combine those two statements together in a way that just flows more logically and is clearer for the customer. Happy to answer any questions.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC 11.37 concerning complaint notices?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, that's all from the Department of Banking.
At this time, the Finance Commission will enter into executive session in accordance with sections 551.07, 071, 551.072, and 551.074 of the Government Code. No final action, decision, or vote with regard to the matter deliberated in executive session will be made until... Just let me know when you're ready back there. You good? Okay. All right, I now reconvene this meeting of the Finance Commission pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. The time is now 11:38. In accordance with Section 551.102 of the Open Meetings Act, No final action, decision, or vote on matters deliberated was made during executive session. No new business? Okay. There being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned, and the time is 11:39.